Call the meeting order. Representative Nelson, front and center. The chairman will move House File 1392 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Why don't you start with Treasurer Greg? In a what's become a long-standing tradition, this will be our third year in a row of doing this with the tax committee. They always seem to enjoy the hearing this bill. Maybe that's why we get to keep bringing it back, Mr. Chairman. But, I'm hoping that we do this right. This will be the last time that you have to hear this piece of proposed legislation. It will not be the end of good quality meat sticks. House File 1392 is before you because in 2001 the legislature adopted a new definition of prepared food as one of the initial steps to bring the state into conformity with the streamlined sales tax project definitions. The new definition, many of you remember, moved bakery products and ready-to-eat meat and seafood sold by weight or volume from the definition of exempt food to the category of taxable prepared food. Taxable prepared food if the product was sold at the place in which it was produced. For example, butcher shops and on-site meat departments of a grocery store. The 2002 legislature adopted the exclusion for bakery products, and at the same time it also adopted a temporary exclusion for ready-to-eat meats and seafoods. That temporary exclusion ends after December 31st of this year, 2005. The bill before you is very small in words. What it does is it removes the expiration date on the temporary exclusion. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we have before you is an opportunity to correct a mistake. All of you have small, especially entrepreneurs within your district that produce these sticks. And to give you an example of how strange this is, first I would like to call on Representative Simpson to give his example, and then, Mr. Chairman, if I might, my witness would like to say a few things, too. Representative Simpson.
Representative Nelson, I get to decide whether we call on Representative Simpson.
Yeah, and if you remember, Mr. Chairman, I did ask your permission first. So. Mr. Chairman, just so you know, those little packages that say Dean's Market on there, that's from Representative Simpson. You'll notice that he does know how to make those things, too.
That's amazing. Okay. Representative Simpson.
Chair Krenke, Representative Nelson, thank you. For those of you who have some of these little packages laying in front of you, I suppose I should get in a plug here because Representative Heidrichton always seemed to mention the fact that he owned some property that had something to do with something. But anyway, what happens under the bill, if it expires, I make this product in my perm store and I can sell it non-tax, or I'll have to charge tax on it. And then I can haul it to my New York Mills store and I won't charge tax on it. So that's the situation of this bill. So what we're trying to do is clean it up and see to it that it's corrected, and I thank Representative Nelson for bringing it forward because it is an issue. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask my testifier from the Minnesota Association of Meat Processors to say a few words, too, if you might.
Welcome to the committee. You'll just give us your name and your position for the record.
Okay. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Greg Endres, E-N-D-R-E-S. My wife Sharon and I own Greg's Meat Processing, a small meat and sausage shop 30 miles south of the cities. I represent the Minnesota Meat Processors Association small meat locker plants. We have approximately 200 members in our organization. That's not counting all the smaller grocery stores in the state of Minnesota. As Representative Simpson and Representative Nelson have said before me this is an unfair tax. It only applies to sausage made and sold in our own stores. And just as Representative Simpson, I have a second outlet. Customers will come in my store, pay tax on my sausage in my store and only my sausage, not Armour's or Johnsonville's or anybody else's. And they go to the other store. We explain to them they got to pay tax on my product. They go to the second store. And then they don't pay tax on the same products. It's just real hard to explain to customers why they had have such an unfair tax. Rural Minnesota is also greatly affected because they have many small meat and sausage shops. The last place they can compete with the big stores is their meat shops with their own ethnic sausages. And they've been handed down from generation to generation. Deer hunters are also affected because there will now be a charge put on deer processing, on the processing of summer sausage, beef sticks, and beef jerky. That's why Mr. Mark Johnson of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association strongly supports the legislation that Representative Nelson has to recommend this here unfair tax. And thank you for listening to our concerns, and I thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In my business that I owned up until November of last year, while under the USDA inspection, I had several hundreds of different sausages that I made for many people. And if I made a particular product, which I did do for Super Value Foods, Cub Foods, they would not collect sales tax when they sold it, nor would I collect it when I sold it to them. But at the same time, in my retail portion of my business, where I displayed 35 different types of sausages, I would be required to collect sales tax on that, manufactured with the same staff, the same equipment, on the same site, under the same inspection services. At the same time, I could ship in a product made by Uncle George, George A. Hormel, and I could display that right alongside of my award-winning wieners. I would charge you a sales tax if you bought the homemade wieners, but not charge your sales tax on Uncle George's. I think it's pretty easy to see that those types of inequities don't belong in statute or even in common sense. I invite all of you to enjoy what we brought you today. Feel free to lick your fingers. Keep in mind, I don't think any of you, though, have the ability to lick your elbow. Mr. Chairman, that concludes our testimony. We're open for questions.
Questions of committee members? Representative Rukavina?
Well, no, I support Representative Nelson's efforts because we don't tax food in this state. Do you mind if I eat while I'm talking?
You're a ranger, it's allowed.
I know. Especially on the day of the ranger. But, you know, it's not that...
Glad he doesn't have a beer with him.
It's not that expensive of a bill. And, you know, when we conformed, I don't even know why we bother to do that, if it's sales tax issue, the state, because we got in trouble once, you know, with the bread issue, and your bill makes sense. And I know you're going to be voting for tax increases to pay for this, Representative Nelson, so I'm with you on that.
If I might, Ms. Baker, can you give us, Mr. Michaels, where are we with regard to this issue and streamlined sales? I'm sorry, Pat, anybody. Bonus toss-up question. Who wants to take it? Pat.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was some attempt to address this issue in Streamline back in 2001. There had been a modification made in the language to allow food sold by a seller whose primary NIACS classification was manufacturing to be exempt, and we thought we were going to be picking up the butchers with that modification. Unfortunately, they are not in the manufacturing NIACS code. They are in a retail NIACS code, and which is why we enacted the temporary exemption to try to go back and work on it. Streamline has not been willing to do any further modifications, but my understanding from talking to people in the Department of Revenue that making this a permanent exemption would not make us substantially out of compliance with Stream 1.
Representative Rukavina, do you have a question?
My comment was, who cares if we're out of compliance? I mean, they're not going to make us, you know, attach ourselves to Canada, which would be good. We could get good prescription drugs. You know, nobody's going to kick us out of the United States of America.
Representative Rukavina, this is just asking questions of staff. This is we get to make the decisions. They just give us the information by which to make the decisions. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nelson, Representative Nelson, I'm sorry.
Revenue is here. If you need any comments further from them on that, otherwise.
Well, as long as Revenue's here, let's hear from them on this weighty topic.
It sure smells good in here, Mr. Chair.
If you testify, you get to add some.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And as Representative Nelson did testify, this issue has been around for the last couple of years, and which has given the department the ability to kind of talk about this issue with the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, and in particular the business organizations and groups that are working on this issue. And we have been given numerous assurances that if this is the only issue that Minnesota is out of conformity with the project, that this wouldn't be a problem for Minnesota. They see this more as a local issue, that it's locally prepared and sold meats. They don't see this as a problem as far as being in conformance with the project, Streamline project.
Mr. Hanson, we've had some discussions previously about enforcement. Can you give us an idea of if we pass this legislation, what is going to happen to the small business owner who perhaps didn't collect sales tax over the or is there an issue of compliance? Let's put it that way. I said this is just this legislation just removes the sunset, correct?
That's correct. So they're not collecting the tax now on these products, and this would just say that going forward they also wouldn't have to. So this just removes that sunset of the exemption.
Representative Rukavina.
So what happens to the state that we, this group that, do we get, they shoot the tax factor or something?
No.
What happens
to us? Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, well, the whole objective of the Streamline is that the states come in with common definitions and taxing things kind of similarly. And we can pick and choose, but as long as we define things similarly, then remote sellers, that eases the burden on them to administer and comply with the tax laws. So the hope is that down the road that there may be some federal legislation or a court case that would allow us to collect the sales tax from the remote vendors, these remote sellers, which would provide an equal playing field and fairness for our Main Street retailers that are competing with those folks. So the whole hope is that this project can bring these laws together and ease the burden and enforce some kind of action that would require those remote sellers to collect the tax.
Is there anyone in the audience who wants to give additional testimony either in favor of House File 1392 or in opposition to House File 1392? If not, any other questions by members? If not, the chair will lay over House File 1392 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Nelson. Thank you for the nourishment.
You're very welcome, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Chairman? Representative House.
If we're going to follow the agenda, I would like to move House File 991.
Representative Howes moves House Bill 991 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Heigerty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you, Representative Simpson. And I have a bill here that I can't get Charlie Scapé into it. So, and yet at the same time, Representative Nelson's a hard act to follow, and Representative Rukavina. I was going to bring a bottle of Shaker's vodka from Ben Smith made out of ethanol, but I was told we could not bring alcohol on the premises, so at least if you want to stay outside of press. But anyways, with that in mind, the bill in front of you is House File 991, and basically what it does, and we're going to be very brief here. What we basically have right now, the ethanol payments, a lot of them going to the plants are done. They're going back into the general revenue. And we're looking at an incentive for the small gas stations in particular putting in E85 pumps. Right now, if you drive from St. Paul to Fargo, as of last year, you could pick up E85 at Monticello, and there wouldn't be any other ones. Now, I understand Barnesville has one as well. So it's a long stretch of miles where there aren't any E85 pumps. There's a cost of anywhere around $40,000 to $50,000 of putting these in. So anyways, we needed to come up with some kind of incentive. And flexible fuel vehicles are growing. We know that a good part of the state fleet already has that, and I understand that they are putting gasoline in them because they too have the same problem of finding E85 stations. At Freeport, I would have to drive 35 miles to put in E85. I'd have to go down to Belgrade. But the governor's initiatives, long-range initiatives, also have this in his initiatives, as do many of the environmentalists. But anyways, more than one half of all the states have passed alternative fuels-related incentives. Pretty much that's in it in a nutshell, and I will introduce Mr. Tim Gerlach of the American Lung Association, who's been working very diligently on this matter.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll give us, again, your name and your position for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tim Gerlach. I'm Director of Outdoor Air Programs at the American Lung Association of Minnesota. Since 1998, we have been the point of contact for a private-public coalition which is charged with installing E85 fueling sites in Minnesota, working with car dealers, consumers, fleets, trying to connect those flexible fuel vehicles with E85. We have been somewhat successful in that. However, as Representative Heidgerken has pointed out, this is a costly process and not everyone can do it. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill and also to offer any technical background or answer any questions I might be able to.
Any questions by committee members?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Heidgerken. There is one in Breckenridge that I know, but they are far and few between. And one question I had, I see this is effective after whatever, 2005. Is there any way some of the ones that have already got the pumps and so forth, is there any type of credit they could receive, or I mean,
thank you. Yeah, we looked at that, and previous to this, and Tim Gerlach could talk a little bit about it. But there has been some grants for the people that bought these cars, and there are some in place. And I think there eventually some of them are going to run out as well. But Tim, you probably could.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, the vast majority of stations in operation in Minnesota have received some sort of assistance from our program. Some of it's federal funding, private funding, such as the Minnesota Corn Growers, even Ford Motor Company at one point was helping us get some stations in. There are those, however, that have done it on their own.
Any additional questions? Representative Rukavina.
Ask my good buddy,
where is he going to get the money? Huh? It's a $6.8 million.
It's six. So,
Representative Heiger, can where are you paying for this, Otto?
Okay, again, it's a tax credit. I realize that it's we do oftentimes we have done. Basically, what I would like to do, Representative Bukovina, is that one half of our ag budget is the ethanol payments, and eventually they're all going back into the general revenue. I would like to see some way in which we're promoting agriculture out there in one way or another. The good thing about the ethanol is a byproduct which is used in livestock. There is no loss in this. It's just a win-win situation for not only the livestock and the dairy farmer, but also for the corn, the wheat. Now, wheat's being used. And I understand there's an ethanol plant going up in the range where they're going to use wood byproducts. So, again, it'd be a winner also for the range, Representative Rocabina.
Mr. Chair, great beef, Representative Heiger. Are you going to get the money again?
Okay, it would be a tax credit, and I understand that it would be a cost to the state of Minnesota. And we've got a fiscal, I think, a report there in front of you. But then again, that's based on if 60% of the gas stations are going to put them in, and I don't foresee that. I could see one town probably having an E85 station, but again, it would be pretty much the same place. Where it's coming from right now is from the ethanol payments that are being made at 13 cents.
That's, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rookman.
I just love it when you Republicans manipulate the free market system.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 991? If not, any further questions? Mr. Michael, can you explain to us lines 20 through 23? Is this a fairly common language when we're giving tax credits?
Mr. Chairman, it's not common in the context of business credits. The state does have a number of refundable credits for low-income taxpayers, as the working family and working family credit, the dependent care credit, and the K-12 education credit. And I guess you could also put the political contribution refund into that category, although it's not administered as part of the income tax. But essentially what this does is make this program like a grant program for the qualified businesses that don't have enough income to pay tax.
Representative Heigerken, is there some reason why you have a cash refund to
Again, this businesses? Is something that was crafted by the Ag Research Department, and they had it in there. There had to be... I looked at that as well, and there had to have been a reason for that being, and I really couldn't answer that why that such a reason.
Mr. Chairman, I will say that it would be a little bit unusual, I would think, for taxpayers who are operating a business to not be required to file a tax return, even if they have no profit. That would require them to pay tax, they normally would still be required to file a return because they have, you know, substantial gross receipts, and they have to claim their business expenses to show that they don't have adequate income. So I'm not sure how many businesses this would really apply to that don't have a return filing requirement at all.
I agree with you, and I really represent Mike Green here. I can't think of any that would qualify for it under that Section B. We're looking at line 20. But
yeah. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, instead of this cash refund on there, why wouldn't we do this as a, if they can't use the credit immediately due to the five-year carry-forward or something? I don't see that we'd want to be doing a cash refund. Just a comment.
I have no problem with that.
Mr. Michael, what about allowing the... what about allowing it as a carry forward?
Mr. Chairman, that is a much more standard provision for business tax credits. If that is to be done, not only would the lines 21 through 23 need to be dropped from the bill, but also the more common circumstance that says that if you file a tax return and don't have tax liability, that you get a refund, which appears on lines 17 through 19. But, for example, the next bill dealing with the research credit, that does have a 15-year carry forward, and that's a pretty typical carry forward under the federal business tax credits. And so that would be another way. Then you would only give it to taxpayers who eventually have enough income to pay tax equal to the credit. It does diminish the incentive effect of it, obviously, for these businesses that don't have tax liability. And I have no idea how much it would reduce the revenue estimate either. I'm sure it would reduce that by, you know, some.
Representative Heiger, maybe you could work with tax staff to get an amendment prepared for your bill and said so that we could remove the provision here that it would be a cash refund, and rather, as Representative Simpson saying, could be deducted over a period of several years with regard to the income tax return. Any additional questions by members? Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heiger, and just as far as you know, the cost of a new tank, it says is approximately $32,000. But some of these stations, can they just be retrofitted in order to accommodate the E85, or do they have to have a whole new tank?
Okay, and I'll let Tim answer that because he works exclusively with them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, certainly there are those stations that, because of existing equipment or their setup, might be converted at a lower cost. Generally speaking, the higher volume locations, those along main thoroughfares or perhaps the sites that might be more attractive to our program for selling more fuel, tend to cost more. And these, I believe, the way this is written, would include new installations. And I saw the estimate of $32,000 as well. Although we occasionally see a bid of that level, generally new installations are considerably more expensive, maybe in the $40,000 to $50,000 range. Thank you.
Just one other question. The information provided here with regard to E85 station and vehicle listing, are these the only vehicles that currently have meet the flexible fuel requirements?
Mr. Chairman, currently this is the list. However, we understand that Ford, General Motors, Daimler Chrysler, and possibly others have more models coming later this year, including several sedans, pickup trucks, and others. I believe the announcements are generally made in the May or June time frame for the coming model year.
And if I wanted to convert my vehicle, is that possible, and what would it cost?
Mr. Chairman, it is possible. However, there are some restrictions for converting vehicles with the U.S. EPA. Generally, it's not really worth it. There are a lot of these vehicles on the road, and our sense is that the trend is to build more of these, so you'll see a wider variety available. For instance, my family purchased a Ford Taurus off the used car lot here recently, so there are a lot in circulation now.
Okay. Any other questions, members? If not, Chairman will lay over House File 991 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Pepin, welcome to the committee. The chairman will move House File 1357.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is about research and development tax credits. Currently, corporations are allowed to claim a research and development tax credit. Right now, that credit is 5% on the first $2 million of qualified R&D expenses and 2.5% on qualified R&D expenses over $2 million. My bill would increase the R&D tax credit to a flat 6% for all qualified research expenses for the taxable year over the base amount and would eliminate the second tier. House File 1357 also provides funding for the bioscience zone. Current law provides for $1 million in state tax benefits to qualified businesses within the biotechnology and health sciences industry zone for fiscal year 2004 and 2005. My proposal authorizes $2 million in state tax benefits for biotechnology zone businesses in fiscal year 2006, and any amount not awarded in 2006 would be allowed to be used in 2007. I believe that both aspects of the bill are important, especially if you consider the competition we are facing from other states. And I don't have a chart with me, but just some examples of other states. California has this is in relation to the R&D credit. They have a tax credit of 15%, Indiana 10%, North Dakota 8%, it's tier 8 and 4%, Pennsylvania 10%, Rhode Island 10%, and ours is at 5%, and that tiers down to 2.5%. While this bill would require an investment to the state, I believe, and studies have shown, that the economic benefit to the state outweigh the cost. I'd also like you to consider that on average, R&D jobs pay $70,000 per year, and each of those jobs produces a taxable income average of $50,000. If we want our state to be competitive and we want high-paying jobs, and we think it's important that we encourage research and development, then please support my bill. And I'd be happy to take questions, and perhaps if the schedule allows to take testimony.
Well, if there are people here to testify, let's bring them forward.
Thank you, Chairman, members. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Medical Alley. We are a trade association representing over 500 members in Minnesota in all parts of the medical world, from the med tech companies to health insurance and to health providers as well. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here to speak on both this bill and Representative Cole's bill, which follows. But we would like to express our support for House File 1357. If there are questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Representative Rukavina.
Chair, again, to Representative Pepin, not to my good friend, Mr. Griffin. How are you paying for this? It's pretty hefty when it's, $22 million bucks a year isn't chump change by any means, so.
Well, obviously, it's a discussion we need to have in the state, and it's I'll leave it at the hands of the committee to decide if this is something that we want to invest in. I believe, and I believe the studies have shown that the amounts that we invest are returned to the state. So it is a big amount of money, but it's something that's important, I think, if we want to remain competitive with our neighbors. North Dakota, as I mentioned, has 8% research and development. That's pretty huge, and I just don't want to see Minnesota fall behind, and I don't want to see businesses leave, and I don't want to see the good research and development ideas they have go to other states.
Well, Representative Pepin, Mr. Chair, I don't think
Representative Rukavina.
I don't think you have to worry about us falling behind North Dakota.
A leading research.
Matter of fact, most of them live on the Minnesota border, so trying to get into the state.
I don't think we've closed that border, have we?
Not yet.
There is a toll bridge.
any question, Representative Vanderveer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this would be for
Representative Pepin or staff, but how do you determine what expenses qualify as R&D? Is that a pretty objective set of criteria somewhere else in statute? Or
Mr. Michael, do you want to help me out with that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, the definition of qualifying research expenses is determined under federal law, and it largely excludes depreciable property, but otherwise includes the source of it. It's mainly the salaries and expenses you pay to employees who are engaged in qualifying research, and the supplies that you purchase that are ordinary supplies, not, you know, capital equipment sorts of things. And there is a definition under federal law of what qualified research is, and it basically requires some form of innovation. It's not, you know, simply modifying an existing product or something of that nature. So I guess the short answer is it's the federal law rules that the companies use to get the federal research and development credit.
Thank you.
And I'd like to just point out, Representative Vandeveer, that this is in excess of the base amount. So this is, for example, if a company is already doing X amount, you know, $200,000 worth of R&D or whatever, they would have to increase that to be eligible for this credit. It does not count if they're already doing it.
Okay. Other questions from members? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krinke. And I guess just a question for Mr. Michael, if I may. The Internal Revenue Code, you were just discussing what you can, how you can qualify. Isn't there something that you can also amortize costs related to R&D that if they're based on a formula or something that you can't sort of declare a useful life, there's something else you can do? And does this bill affect that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I think what you're referring to is that when a business makes capital expenditures, those expenditures are not ordinarily allowed to be fully deducted in the year in which they're incurred, because the theory of the income tax is that they have a longer useful life. And so under normal circumstances, those expenses would need to be capitalized and then deducted over a period of years. In fact, not under this credit, but there's a separate set of rules that allow expensing our current deduction of research and development expenses under federal law, which Minnesota conforms to. So that's sort of a second benefit that research and development qualifies under the tax code that's really not affected by this. But what this does say is that if you claim them on the credit, then that reduces the amount of the expensing, so the two provisions sort of intersect together.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krinke. Just as a follow-up, and maybe it's a question, I don't know if it's for Representative Pepin or the testifier or for someone in revenue, but in looking at the note, if I understand it correctly, it's just changing the credit to a flat 6% as opposed to the 5 plus 2.5 as you go over 2 million. When the revenue note was created for this, is there a calculation in part of this to say that part of the cost here is that we're going to anticipate by going from 5 to 6 that somehow a lot more companies are going to participate in this, or is it just the flat change from 5 to 6? I mean, is there an activity part in the revenue note here as well? And I don't know if it's the Department of Revenue, or I don't know who would answer this. But I guess, Mr. Chair, just so while people think about answering that, where I'm going with this is I don't like credits. And, in fact, I think I'm a co-author on Representative Cole's bill next, and I'll frequently co-author them with people. But just in general, I just don't like them. I mean, I think they're really inefficient. They don't get the money in a very efficient way. If you're trying to provide relief, just provide the relief. So, you know, from a tax perspective, I just don't usually like them. But I'm not sure what's driving this particular one or the next one. So it's a criticism of myself as well, Representative Pepin, because as I've said, I've co-authored one, you know, one here this year and probably some more. But I'm not convinced that the 5%, you know, is not working. I mean, are there a whole bunch of other companies that are coming and saying, geez, if it were 6%, then we do it. And that's just the part I'm questioning here.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lencheski. It's my understanding that about 200 additional corporations would qualify under my bill. And now that's a significant amount of companies in Minnesota. And I think the idea is we want to encourage companies to do this. And so that's why I'm supportive of the bill and legislation. That's only part of your question, probably, and maybe revenue would have some more detail on that. But that is my understanding about the number of companies.
Mr. Griffin, do you want to respond to Representative Lencheski?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I don't want to disagree with my other. I'm kind of a little bit short because I believe the number of companies, and I'm looking to the department to confirm, I think is about 30 that we've got under under our provision.
No, but no? 200. Yeah. You're referring to Representative Holmes.
I'm looking at Representative Holmes filling up. I'm sorry.
It's 200, trust me. Mr. Chair.
200, Jack.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question, and I probably wasn't being clear, is it 200 brand new companies or 200 companies who are getting 5% who are now going to get 6? Or is it of those 200 companies, you know, 170 are getting 5 and now they're going to get 6 and we're going to get 30 new ones? I mean, who are we trying to get here, and is this the most efficient way to do it? So, again, it's probably whoever did the revenue note, and I don't know if they're here today, would be able to answer this question as who this is really targeted for.
Do we have someone from the Department of Revenue that could comment with regard to the note?
Mr. Wilson?
Okay.
All
right. Well, we can follow up with the department and get some additional information with regard to what the anticipation of the companies who currently aren't getting the R&D credits, but versus, the revenue note does talk about 200 taxpayers would receive larger R&D credits, but that doesn't give us much information as to whether we would anticipate there would be new companies who would be receiving that credit. Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Chair Krenke. This, again, may be explore along similar lines as Representative Lencheski. I'm wondering, Representative, if you have any information on the distribution of the companies who might take advantage of this credit. It seems that the structure of the current credit, given that the percentage is higher for expenses in R&D under $2 million, biases our system towards small businesses. And by bringing it up to 6% for everybody, we lose that kind of progressive small business piece. And so I'm wondering, as you're looking at those 30 or 200 or whatever, what's the distribution maybe by market capitalization or some other valuation? Are we skewing this towards the big corporations in the state and away from an incentive for small companies, entrepreneurial startups, and that sort of thing?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, it's geared towards C corporations, and maybe Mr. Michael could talk about that, a little bit about the size of the companies. I don't have a breakdown of exactly which companies, but...
Mr. Chairman, with regard to C corporations versus S and partnerships, the Minnesota credit only applies to C corporations, so the recipients of the credit are C corporations. I was looking through my file, I can't see it. My understanding is that the vast majority of the credit, and the number that sticks in my mind is in the 70 to 80% range, is actually claimed by large business, by the larger corporations. I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is on that. And you can imagine why when you think about, you know, the amount of research and development that's done by large Fortune 500 companies, you know, thinking about, for example, our big headquartered companies here like 3M and General Mills and Medtronic and so forth. Obviously, all of those companies have very large research operations, many employees in Minnesota. And so, as one would guess, they're the ones that get most of the credit as it is. And I think nationally, that's also true. you know, that's the general circumstance. There are smaller businesses that get it, but the benefit is relatively small.
Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify in favor or in opposition of House File 1357? Representative Mulrich.
Mr. Chairman, we're taking up Representative Cole's next thing.
Okay. He'll be next. So, Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chair, can I just make a quick comment to Representative Lynchewski's question? There shouldn't be any new taxpayers that come into the credit because we're not changing the definition of qualified expenses or the base at all. It's just a matter of you'll get more credit based on your qualifying expenses. So it will be the 200 taxpayers that will get a larger credit, and it shouldn't change the population of who qualifies.
Thank you.
Yeah. If there are no further discussion of House File 1357, the chairman will lay over House File 1357, possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House File 1356 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1356 is the R&D tax credit light, and I apologize for being late. I'm supposed to be outside in the rain right now as a member of the State Quarter Dollar Commission participating in celebrations out in front of the Capitol, so I apologize for not being here during Representative Pepin's bill. My bill, unlike Representative Pepin's bill, phases in the tax credit up to 5% over 3 years. The revenue note is significantly less than Representative Pepin's for that reason. Members, I think Representative Pepin probably covered the policy behind the bill, why we're bringing this forward. I'd be happy to go into that more. I know Mr. Griffin and others are here if people have specific questions, but the difference between my bill and Representative Pepin's bill is that mine doesn't go to 6% right away. It goes up to 5% over 3 years. The reason for that, members, is that I felt, given our current budget situation, I certainly would love to go to 6% right away. I think it's the right policy. I think it's the right thing to do. But I'm not sure that we can make that work this year during this budget cycle. If we can figure out a way to make it work and Representative Pepin's bill becomes the bill that gets included, I'm certainly supportive of that. That's the difference between the two proposals. I'd be happy to stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Representative Rukabina.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask Representative Cole the same question I've asked the other presenters this morning. Where do you pay for this, Representative Cole?
Well, Representative Rukabina, I know you've been asking that question. I have the fiscal analyst's information on collections. Collections for the February and March are $73 million above forecast. So I guess we got $73 million more we can spend.
Mr. Chair? No, you don't, because you agreed in and the when I 03 bill that money was going towards education and to pay for the buyback of
Representative Rukavina, that was the legislature from the last biennium. This legislature can do anything that it wants. We're not bound by what happened in the 2003-2004
session. That's true, Mr. Chair.
We got the money.
And you would take money away from kids to give to corporations. That's true.
I don't look upon it as taking away money from the children. I don't think the money goes to the children, Representative Rukumi, does it?
I think it eventually
does. I think it goes to the school district, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it goes to the children eventually. They get educated.
Do they?
Yeah,
my daughter doesn't get any money when... She attends public
school. I'm sure if anybody's daughter gets money, it's yours.
For the children. Representative Rukumi, I just
You know, since you brought up my daughter, I just want to share this with committee members, if they'll indulge me, that my wife was driving my daughter to school last week, and the car in front of them had three bumper stickers. One was the Kerry Edwards, one was Paul Wellstone, and the other one was my opponent from the last election. And my daughter, who's in a very astute 9-year-old, said, "Look, Mom, two losers and a dead guy." Anyway, she's 9, okay? Anyway,
she's your daughter.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I actually signed on to Representative Pepin's bill, thought worth looking into, and then I started looking more into this issue, and I think there's a real problem with this. Actually, this A1 amendment that I just had handed out, I'm not going to formally offer it today. I may do that or something similar at markup time or whatever. But I think there's a real problem with where we're going on this. I haven't seen any evidence that we're getting anything out of this. And the more the testimony comes out in each committee, it seems to strengthen that. By the way, I also have a bill, and I don't know if it's going to be scheduled or not, that gets at the smaller corporations, the S corporations, and smaller ones where there's actually more evidence that it may end up helping us because it would entice new corporations to start in Minnesota and grow here where there'd be eventually more jobs. On looking into this more, these percentages don't mean a lot. We're not losing business for research to North Dakota. In fact, I think in total spending, we're definitely in the top 10 and probably between 3rd and 8th or 7th. It's hard to get exactly where we are. We don't really know anything about this. And I think what we really need to do is have a study done by the tax department or by the Department of Revenue before we start giving out a lot of money that we don't necessarily get anything from. I firmly believe in helping grow businesses if it adds to our economy, jobs, tax base, things like that. But I see nothing resulting from these two bills that we have evidence of yet. And I think we need to actually do a study on this before we start giving out very substantial amounts of money here. And, I don't know if you want to discuss that now or if we bring that up later during the session or whatever.
Well, we'll have appreciate you bringing the amendment, Representative Mullery, for discussion purposes. Representative Coles, you had an opportunity to review the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I have had a chance just now to review it. Representative Mullery, I appreciate that you're not formally offering this right now. I'm willing to talk to you about this. This may be something that makes some sense. I guess I'm not saying that I'm opposed to it. I also haven't had a chance to think about it or fully understand the implications of it. And I don't know what the cost would be. We'd have to talk to the department about what it would cost. But I'm happy to, I want to make sure that what we're doing makes some sense. But we did hear testimony in the previous committees that while tax policy isn't the only thing that drives a business to make decisions, it certainly is one of the things that goes into deciding where are we going to expand our research and development facilities, where are we going to add the new $70,000, $80,000 a year jobs. And so I want to make sure that what we're doing makes sense so that we can attract and retain and grow as many of those jobs as possible here in Minnesota. And if a study is the right way to go, let's talk some more about that. I'm certainly open to the idea. I appreciate that you're not putting me on the spot and making me say yes or no today because I'd probably say no just because I don't fully understand what this would all imply. But I'd be happy to work with you on it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coles, I just thought this morning So I just, for the first time, read the exact language. I had mentioned it, in fact, to the lobbyists before that I was looking into this. But I agree that if we're going to produce a lot bigger tax base, a lot more jobs, then something I think is good for the state. If we're not accomplishing that and there's another way to do it, I would rather go down that route. And before putting out a lot of money, I'd like to have a real... I don't think we know, and I don't know if a lot of people on this committee know whether we really are going to get much from this or not. I don't think we have a lot of independent analysis of that, and I would trust that the Department of Revenue would do an independent analysis for us of the real effects of this thing. So well, we can work together as this goes along.
Mr. Manson, would you like to comment on the proposed amendment that Representative Mullery has brought forward? Since the amendment asks the department to prepare a study on the in this topic area.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Manson. And yeah, I'm just saying this for the first time myself. So I think we, if a study was, if the department was asked to do a study, I think we could pull some of this information together. I don't know how much information we have on the job creation or whether another department or some consultant needs to help us with determining those factors. But and then, of course, studies do cost money, so I do see there's an appropriation in there. So I'm not sure how much this would cost, or but it may be something that's worth visiting.
Okay. Any other comments or questions of members by the Representative Mullery's proposal? If not, Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate committee members' support. I know it's going to get laid over for further consideration, and I hope that when it comes time to mark up the bill that we will have some money in the tax budget to do a few of these things that are going to help retain and grow good jobs here in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience who cares to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 1356?
I'd like to testify in opposition.
He just rode in from Albert Lee. So.
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin again with Medical Alley. Mr. Chairman, we were prepared to testify on this bill, and Representative Kepman asked us to testify on her bill as well. But as I said, Medical Alley represents a group of companies within the 350-mile stretch from the Twin Cities to Rochester with over 500 members. This is an area which has seen an increase in employment of 31% between 1992 and 2003, over 21,000 jobs. We have a concentration of employment that's over three times that of the national average in the biotech and medical industry. We rank second only to California in the medical device industry, and we have very good potential for growth for 5 to 10 years. Our top manufacturers alone can grow, under our current studies, at least 8,000 jobs, perhaps 12,000 jobs the next 5 to 7 years. We have currently over 520 companies in Minnesota who have approved medical device, which are approved medical device companies, and we have, just in our 10 largest manufacturers, over $18 billion in worldwide sales per year. There are a number of factors that the legislature can take credit for in having the kind of impact on the economy that we have because of the state's ability to influence a variety of factors that help us grow these jobs. The degree of involvement by our research institutions, whether it be the University of Minnesota or the Mayo Clinic, the availability of capital, a stable and supportive tax and regulatory environment, and a long-term perspective for increased funding for math and sciences. There's also technological innovation that is driven by economic growth in America. Two-thirds of our per capita economic growth stems directly from technological innovation. The R&D tax credit is a federal and state tool which can be used to stimulate technological innovation. At least 34 states have their own versions of the R&D tax credit, and it provides incentives for firms to invest in research and development. Minnesota's had this policy in place since 1987. We believe that companies seldom retain all of the benefits of research, particularly risky and early-stage research. Economists find that companies systematically underinvest in R&D, and we believe that this type of tax credit can help to correct that type of problem. As you heard Representative Pepin say, there are some glaring examples of other states that are out there. As you know, Minnesota currently has a 5% of the current year expenditure over the base, and 2.5% for over $2 million as R&D, as our R&D tax credit. Rhode Island has 22% over the base, Hawaii 20, Arizona 20 over the base, and 11% over $2.5 million. California, as you've heard, 15% over the base. Massachusetts, New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Indiana, 10% over the base. Wisconsin, 5% over the base. We believe the competition for R&D jobs has increased significantly over the past 5 years. R&D tax credits boost the business climate for high-tech innovation investment, since, as you've heard, high-tech jobs pay more than 75% more than non-high-tech jobs, and average on the average $70,000 per year in income. The state's already made the decision as a matter of tax policy to provide research credits, and we believe that this increase to 5% over 3 years would go a long way towards making Minnesota competitive. Companies regularly review opportunities to expand or create new investment in R&D operations. We heard at the committee level and subcommittee level from both Guidant and St. Jude. St. Jude is a company which has now currently 2,000 jobs in California and will be making decisions as to whether to invest there or their other plant, which is in Arizona, which has 500 jobs in it currently. Guidant has 1,200 researchers in their facility just north of the Capitol here, and will be making decisions on how they expand and how they make those decisions. As Representative Cole said, these decisions are not made solely on the R&D tax credit, and there are a number of other issues which come into play. Mr. Chairman, Medical Alley has not been in front of this committee asking for tax credits, asking for tax breaks for our members. I've passed out for you our legislative agenda, which is similar to where it's been in the past few years. We are here and very thankful to Representative Dorman and his committee, and to the bonding conferees that managed to pass through a bonding bill. Our number one priority this year was the passage of the Mayo University joint venture in genomics. We believe that that is the kind of thing that the state can do to continue to spur economic investment. We also lobbied very strongly for the university's translational research facility, which was in the last bonding proposal to pass the legislature, and we believe that that will go a long ways towards spurring these kinds of innovations. Mr. Chairman, we believe that education is part of the package that goes towards making our state a great state and will help continue keep us in the forefront of medical and biotechnical innovation. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are questions, we'd be happy to answer them. As Representative Cole said, we worked with him to draft this legislation to phase this in. We are not here asking for a 15% credit. We do think that this would help us to remain competitive as these decisions are made by our members. If there are questions, I would be happy to take them.
The questions of the witness. Thank you very much, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 1356? If not, thank you, Representative Coles. We'll lay over House File 1356 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chair.
Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may, but I know as you're calling up the next bill, I just have a process question for the committee. Thinking about these revenue notes, Representative Pepin and Cole's bills got us all thinking about who the beneficiaries are and then how does the revenue note come together. And I recall that earlier in the session when we had, I believe, Commissioner Salamone here presenting the governor's proposal back when it had a casino in the revenue note, we had requested a number. I think Representative Dorman, I, Mullery, Atkins, could we get that fleshed out? How did that? Where did that money come from? The committee still has not received that information, and I'd just like to ask you, Mr. Chair, if when we do those gambling bills, and what's making me think about this is the discussion, plus at noon, the Mall of America is releasing their study that shows that, you know, they can put all the other proposals to shame if the state really wants the money. And at noon, they're going to put out their $1 billion that's going to come out of the mall proposal for a casino every year. So, you know, as we look at all these proposals, thinking about how the committee looks at the revenue notes, my understanding from asking staff here is a lot of those numbers really get pulled from the Minnesota Lottery. And I guess the name there is Don Keeney. I don't know who that is. But I wonder if Mr. Chair and then the hospitality industry has a lot of the numbers relating to these revenue notes as well. And they're coming through probably the sales tax division in revenue, but also they may be coming from deed. And when you do have those hearings, you know, I would hope that we could get those people in the room on that day, because I know Mr. Manson and others do a great job of just sort of fielding all questions on revenue notes, and they kind of, who's ever here answers them. But I think the day we do all those casino proposals, we really need to have the folks who are putting together these numbers of what's coming out of what machine and what hotel that's creating these revenue notes, because I think that's been an ongoing question bipartisanly of the committee as to where are these numbers coming from. And so I just hope that, Mr. Chair, you would have those people through your committee administrator, or I can work on that, to get the correct people into the room for the day we hear those bills.
Sure. We'll be happy to do that, Representative Lucheski.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to move House File 309 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. I have two folks here to testify with me, Mr. Johnson from the insurance industry and Mr. Nitz from a corporation that offers long-term care. This is and my apologies, Representative Lucheski, we're making you look bad twice in one day because you're on this bill too. But this is a bill Representative Coles had last session. My particular interest, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is from personal experience. As many of you know or have heard here, we've had the discussion about family farms, and as Representative Simpson said, it's a sad day when Zellers is the voice of agriculture in the tax committee. But my family farms has been farming for over 100 years now, and when my grandfather was looking at retiring in long-term care, we knew that there's a good chance with some of his health conditions that he was going to end up in a nursing home. From the time that I actually talked about introducing this bill, not only has that all come to fruition, but he has moved all the way through the process. He went from living in his own home to an assisted living apartment and is now in the nursing home. My uncle took out this long-term care insurance, albeit in another state, to help us save the family farm. If left with no other device, he would have to sell off property to pay for some of the long-term care for my grandfather, who now with congestive heart failure is reaching the maximum of what you would have to spend. Here in Minnesota we have, and Mr. Chairman, I didn't include this in the packet, but there's an editorial from the Star Tribune. I wanted to get a hearing, so I didn't put this in, Mr. Chairman. It says that next to Hawaii, Minnesota is the second in the nation for life expectancy. And that's really what why I've offered this increase in the tax credit, Mr. Chairman. And you'll see in one of the handouts that we have, the first page, if you flip it over, on the back it says rising long-term care expenditures. And looking out, and I say this to address the fiscal note that is in members' packets, it shows I think the first year is an 8, and then looks out in the out years to $10 and $11 million. If you look down the second bullet point down there, by 2030, total nursing home expenditures are expected to rise to $9.8 billion after adjustments for inflation. So what we're looking at, members, and Representative Davids isn't here, but this truly is for the children. There are kids in grade school that have no idea what they're going to be paying for, but as the rise in Medicaid expenditures rise, it goes up, and there's a long-term care insurance study from the Commerce Department that was offered in Commerce Committee, and if you look at the number of Minnesotans right now that are taking advantage of this and the increases in Medicaid expenditures over the long term, there's about roughly, and I would disagree with the fiscal note, but that's okay, we always disagree. This study says there's about 47,000 Minnesotans. The fiscal note shows 30. That's fine by me when it comes to estimating how much it's going to cost. But going forward in the future, Mr. Chairman, we're going to see these rising costs
exponentially increase and truly going to be put on the backs of our kids. Some of you have colored copies of the other states around us that are offering these credits, or in some cases downright or straightforward deductions, tax deductions. You can see on here what our neighbors are doing, what's happening around the country. Mr. Chair and members, I just offer this as a way to increase individuals' interest in purchasing long-term care and in the long run helping to save our state some money that we're going to have to be paying out. Any questions that we can answer, Mr. Nitz or Mr. Johnson, or I'd be happy to stand.
Questions from members? Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who this is for, but I on the long-term care insurance, which I think is good, but I've had two constituents in the last month who said they've had this insurance for about, one was 5 years, one was 7 or 8 years, and now all of a sudden the premiums have just skyrocketed, and one is dropping out, and the one's going to try to continue, but why is that? And if that's the case, what good is this going to be if it's just going to skyrocket? Is this something that's just happening? Or, but just in the last 2 months, or the last month, I've had two calls.
Sure. And I,
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markwart. And that's actually included the commissioner when he testified in Commerce Committee. Said, you know, I was one of those people that looked at it. And in the study that was offered, and I'll let Mr. Johnson and Mr. Nitz explain some of the demographics or actuarial examples, but when this was being written, the insurance for this, they expected a 7 to 9% a dropout rate. It was a 1 or 2%, or in some cases non-existent, because people saw the benefit. They were expecting, with normal life insurance, any kind of insurance, a dropout rate of blank and blank percentage. So when they wrote it and put the premiums in place, that's what they had as anticipated. But as people were going forward and seeing the rising costs in health care, seeing what happens with their family members, they decided to keep the policy. I would say that going forward, that you're not going to see those dramatic increases or dips or peaks or valleys in the market, because now that this is becoming more and more accessible but appealing to people for the long term, you're not going to see that the insurance industry as a whole, and I won't speak for them, but in the testimony we've had in the two previous committees that we've been before, that was one thing that we found, that the insurance industry, you know, was saying we didn't know we had this great of a product here, and they truly didn't. They expected a higher dropout rate. So those increases you've seen so far are what I would say a point in time or a snapshot in time. Going forward, I don't think you'll see that, but I'll let Mr. Johnson and Mr. Nitz address them if they'd like to as well.
Yes, sir.
We have witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Representative Zellers has fully covered, I think, the information that I had, maybe other than to underscore on the chart that he indicated with total nursing home expenditures to grow to just under $10 billion. I think the second part comment is that half of that will be paid for out of the state budget. So the point in terms of the reason to try to incent and develop the private market is that we're talking about a significant amount of money out of the state budget, you know, at the current splits. And the second comment I would just make is that this is a product that, compared to most products in the marketplace that we all buy and consumers buy, is really in its product infancy, would probably be the right description of it. So I think when you look at the numbers and who's eligible to buy and who can afford, it's been, you know, we're at the early stages of that product growth curve, so it's distinguishable from probably most other products that we all see and know and buy and your constituents in the marketplace. So looking at specific incentives to try to grow that, we think makes some sense, and those are the only comments I'd add, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, follow-up, Representative Markwart, to your question.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still very concerned about these skyrocketing premiums. Now, you know, if I take this out when I'm 35 or 40, when I'm at my maximum income gaining time, I can adjust to that. But both constituents who have called me are seniors on fixed incomes. And, you know, they I mean, the one who has literally paid premiums for 7 or 8 years is quitting, so that money's gone. But they don't have that, and I'm very concerned that there is something that people bought into, and now when it's becoming popular or whatever, I'm hoping it is just a small little snapshot of what's happening, but I'm concerned that there may be more people who ultimately have to drop this coverage when they've bought into it, and they're seniors and they've got nowhere else to go, and they've got money now that they've wasted. And I guess I need a better... what are we looking forward to? I mean, it can't just be because of the dropout rate. I mean, there has to be more.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, and actually, we can follow up post the hearing and get you some specific details about... Commerce Department has to approve any rate changes. And what happened is the assumptions underlying the pricing were wrong. That's as Representative Zeller's described, and without rate adjustments, those companies, they need to stay solvent. If the companies aren't solvent, then they're not going to be there to pay for anything. And so what happened, but not the whole market made that adjustment. I don't have the exact number here, but as I recall, Commissioner Wilson indicated about half the companies selling had a fairly significant change, about half didn't. So it wasn't universal, that rate change, and it was relatively unique. I think if you look at the history of the product, you would not see that kind of change if you looked at it year to year. So there's nothing to suggest, A, that that's the pattern. There's nothing to suggest that it's going to repeat. And so hopefully that gives some context for what happened. But again, the underlying assumptions were wrong on the lapse rates and the underlying assumptions on the investment returns that are built into that pricing also were wrong because of the interest, the investment environment in America that changed and dropped down. And so the pricing has to be accurate or the companies can't stay in business.
Mr. Chair.
And I
appreciate that. I want to see this work. That's why I'm concerned, because I think it is the route. If we're going to keep down costs in the long term, this is the way to go. But I just want to make sure that people can afford it when it gets to a crucial area. So I do appreciate you bringing this bill forward. So thank you.
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, and I do have from the Commerce, and Commissioner Wilson, was when he testified before Commerce Committee, was very honest about it. He said, I looked at it and said, my God, am I going to be able to keep paying for this? And that's part and parcel why this study came out. There's an average policy example in here. So for your particular case, Representative Marcourt, if it's around 45, issued at age 45, it's $1,500 to $3,000 a year. The numbers, in talking with Mr. Nitz, are a little bit high, but it's also based on the coverage plan that is written in here, how much you're going to expect per day in a nursing home, for home health care, inflationary rate, those types of things. Representative Bradley, when we testified before his committee, said he had custom tailored his policy for a longer in assisted living, or unassisted, I should say, apartment living, versus a everyday nursing home intensive care. So he was able to craft the policy as to what he would like it. Same with you as well. So I'd be more than happy to share what an average would be. Yeah, and then Mr. Nitz wanted to have just one comment about the long term.
I'm Dan Nitz. I'm an actuary from Allianz Life. We do write long term care insurance. We've been fortunate today not to have raised our rates. But just one comment about going forward in the future for long term care of the industry. There was a new regulation put in for insurance, long term care insurance, that really makes it much more difficult for long-term care companies to raise rates going forward on new policies. And the industry, not to make excuses for some of the other companies, but when it came into being in the mid-80s, there wasn't a lot of information, and the lapse rates that were used in the pricing, as well as the interest rates that were used, were common at that time. And as been mentioned, that people really did find value in this product and stuck with it. Some of these lumps have been taken. Most companies, have priced very little future lapse rates in and priced in their future high utilization of this product. In addition, there is regulation now that does make it much more difficult for companies to raise rates. So going forward, I think there are some hits the industry took, unfortunately, but I think it's in better shape now. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's always a pleasure to listen to my good friend Bob Johnson testify. He's a nice guy, actually. He just represents the wrong people. But, you know, the insurance industry, I think, can take care of itself. They always do. It's kind of like, you know, they went out to Washington and somehow got in a bill, I think last year or the year before, that if our Daimler amendment didn't come off the books, they're going to start cutting our highway aids, so they can see that you get, you know, if you're within that 10-mile limit range, they can, it gets reported to your insurance company, and then they can jack up your rates. But that's a whole other issue someday. But I'm just curious to fight. Mr. Johnson, what are the annual sales of in Minnesota long-term insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, the current count of policies is about 110,000, 115,000. So I guess I don't, unless Mr. Nitz knows or the study, that's the total amount in place today. But I guess I can't tell you. The Commerce Department says 113,000 Minnesotans currently have policies. And I don't know if we have a number on what's the, you know, the annual sale.
Oh, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Chair, you have those numbers right in your head.
No, not in my head, sir. I have other numbers in my head, not that number.
Can the gentleman from Allianz tell?
I don't know either.
What's the average premium you charge?
It varies by age, but the average premium is around $1,500 to $2,000.
Yeah, we should give this industry a break.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm starting to hear from elder law attorneys that used to recommend long-term insurance, but it's just not a feasible deal. It's getting to be almost a rip-off, they think. And I guess my question is, and what I'm surprised at what's going on. So you can, one of the two industry experts, an insurance company can come out and sell somebody a policy saying your rate will be about here, and then you can just decide later that as an insurance company, now I'm not including some new legislation, but our Commerce Department will approve rate hikes, huge rate hikes, then later, just because the company is having problems with what they told people were going to be the situation? Is that sounds like what I'm hearing.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I mean, insurance fundamentally is about pooling. And, to the last comment, you know, $1,500 annual premium. Right now in Minnesota, an average stay in a nursing home is $60,000 a year. So, I mean, insurance is all about pooling. If more people use it, you know, either the insurance company is going to go bankrupt, and then, you know, nobody in the future is going to have any benefits. You know, so it's all about pooling, and what's happened in the past with some other companies is that, you know, more people used it, and, you know, the premiums they were charging weren't sufficient to cover that pool, and, you know, they needed to raise the rates to stay financially solvent.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, so I thought there was a point and purpose in reinsurance, but so then the average citizen of Minnesotan then gets stuck just because actuaries were wrong or something, it sounds like.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of comments, and I think the Commerce Report, Department Report, if you haven't read it, would be instructive, because from the regulator who's in charge, they put that all in perspective. So it's, I think, a helpful description. But my comment up front about this being compared to virtually every other product consumers buy being in its product infancy, that's an important comment, because most other products, the assumptions, what you see in rate, premium changes, you can track it, you can look at it. The core factors aren't changing, those core assumptions. And, I mean, it's just literally what happened here. And it wasn't all companies, as Mr. Nitz indicated. Some of the core assumptions were wrong, and so the underlying pricing needed to be adjusted. Otherwise, the companies weren't going to stay in business at the core of it, state regulation of insurance, is intended to ensure the solvency of the companies that are selling, or they're not there to make good on the contracts. And Commerce, for those companies, concluded under the current rating laws, and the rating laws generally say rates can't be excessive, so they can't be, you know, unwarranted or high beyond justifiable. They can't be inadequate. They can't be so low that the company can't be in business. That's the solvency standard. And they can't be unfairly discriminatory. So the rating standards that are generally applicable, and if we don't meet that by the numbers, then we can't change rates. And I'm sure the Commerce Department actuary could come to some form and describe to you why it was necessary to permit those companies to adjust their rates, because they weren't satisfying the statutory standards. The uniqueness here compared to auto and homeowners and liability, pick any other line, that those lines have been around for 75 plus years, and some of the core assumptions, we know what they are and they don't change. So you don't have that kind of literally a fundamental repositioning that takes place. Now, having said that, and I think it is a fair description, as earlier with the comments about should there be an expectation of anything more happening, I don't think so, because I think with the change in assumptions that have been made, we don't expect a repeat of that. And we do have actually a long-term care rate stabilization law. I don't have the citation here, but a specific statute that even goes to a kind of a controlling the growth within the marketplace, or premiums within the marketplace. So I think this is an instance that when you look at what happened, you square it with the state rating laws and standards that the regulation is required to enforce, that the changes that happened from those companies needed to take place so that we're staying on target with those rating laws. And I don't think there should be an expectation you're going to see a repeat of that. I think that's the right description of it.
Okay. This is not the Commerce Committee, Representative Mullery. This is not the Health Care Committee. This is the Tax Committee. So,
Mr. Chair,
we have very little time, and we have three more bills on the agenda, Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, there is a reason I was asking, because I think when we give credits to people, we are, as a state, suggesting this is a good thing to do, and that's my concern about inducing people into something.
I understand that. We're getting off into why the rate changes and what the, you know, this has already been through the Commerce Committee, so again, I just don't want us to get too far afield in terms of what's going on. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, my question really dealt more with the commerce issue, too, but I will take the opportunity just to say I really appreciate Mr. Bob Johnson, too, and I think he does represent the right kind of people in the insurance industry. So.
You go with the insurance. Okay, I'll go with it.
Okay. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will probably pass, but if you would let them answer it, and maybe it would only take a second. I was just wondering, when the state raised the cost of private pay insurance by $2,000 a year, did that impact the situation? And I know we're not in Commerce Committee, so you can pass the question. We don't have to answer it.
Well, that's fine. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, when the state raised the what?
Mr. Chair, the state charge private pay nursing home patients $2,000 more in the last biennium and didn't get another ounce of service. Did that affect this at all?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that right here. I don't know if Mr. Nitz knows, or we could follow back up after the committee and respond.
Yeah, I would like you to do that. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess I wouldn't think so. I think the two primary reasons why other companies had rate increases were, again, due to the lapse rates, as well as the interest rate environment. I don't think the change that you mentioned would have a material impact on that.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify either in favor or in opposition to House File 309? Anyone else? 309. If there are no further questions or comments, the chair will lay over House File 309 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank
you, Representative
Chairman
Zellers. Representative Abrams, we're going to have Mr. Johnson come first. I'm sorry. He's not a member of the committee, so we're going to afford him an opportunity Representative Johnson. The chair will move House File 549, possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was before this committee with the same bill last year. I believe Representative Abrams was kind enough to put it in the omnibus bill last year, but as you know, we didn't go much further than that. This bill authorizes the Commissioner of Revenue to pay a property tax refund up to 30 days earlier than is permitted under present law for claims that are submitted electronically. It's permissive. It's not a requirement. I believe that the department is fine with this, but I have brought along with me David Lagermeyer, who is a constituent of mine and actually brought this idea to me. I've asked him to give very brief testimony to you as to his thoughts.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll give us your name and if you represent any organizations for the record, please.
Sure. My name is David Lagermeyer. I'm a CEO of a company called Smart Track Group. Thank you very much for inviting me to this meeting today. I just wanted to share with you a few facts here regarding electronic filing costs to the state. First of all, the first chart that I've got here just shows the cost to the state of a return, whether it's mailed or electronically filed with the state. Basically, three times as much to process a return that's mailed to the state as opposed to one that's electronically filed. The importance of this becomes apparent here when you take a look at the Minnesota M1 return as compared to the property tax refund return, the M1PR. Approximately 62% of all M1 returns are electronically filed with the state today, which is something that you'd sort of expect when you realize that probably 60 to 70% of those people are getting refunds. When you look at the M1PR, where 100% of all people filing those returns get a refund, roughly only 13% are electronically filing them today. The rest of them are mailing them. So basically what that means is that it costs the state more money long term. Now, the existing legislation for the M1PR was written before there was even electronic filing. So if I go out today and I mail this return in the mailbox, or I go out and electronically file a return, you're going to get your refund at the same time, regardless whether you save the state money or not. And basically what we have found out is people, when they electronically file, they expect that they'll get the refunds quicker. So, again, the existing legislation is not written in a way that allows the Department of Revenue to do that. So we're just asking you to tweak the legislation a little bit to provide that incentive for taxpayers so that they can get their refunds quicker. If you've looked at the fiscal notes on this, again, you'll notice that the Department of Revenue pretty much puts this as a zero sum. And, again, I think that a lot of that goes to the fact that they're not expecting it to cost the state any more money if they give the refunds out a month earlier. So any questions that the committee might have?
Questions of committee members? Representative Debney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually is a question for another one of my speculative questions for staff. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend that President Bush's budget for the IRS includes eliminating the very simple telephone filing of tax returns for the very simplest returns, and I'm wondering if the state is expecting to see a decrease in e-filings because of roadblocks being put in front of e-filings for folks on the federal level. Is there a tandem sense to how people file their returns, and how would that impact Representative Johnson's legislation here?
Bonus toss-up question. Who wants it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, yes, I'm not sure that I'm qualified to speculate. I think that the speculation is very qualified. As I understand that proposal, what it's doing is eliminating this small subset of e-filing, which is where it's done over the telephone, that's been declining over the past number of years. I think the department, which would be better able to talk about this, has wondered whether it still makes sense to keep offering that option as fewer and fewer taxpayers use it. And I think part of the rationale is that there are more ways to directly file over the internet that are free, and they think that more taxpayers will avail themselves of doing that. My guess is that pulling the plug on telefiling, though, will reduce the number of electronic returns, because there are some people that that's the most convenient way for them to do it, and if they don't have that option, they won't be able to do that. I don't know if Jack or somebody else from the department has any other thoughts on that. And I don't, and I think that once the federal telefile option is gone, if Congress agrees with the administration, that the state, I think, can continue to still do the telefile, because we have them enter all of their federal return information that they need to do in order to file again to do the state telefiling. It's not a joint federal state operation.
Any other questions? Representative Winchester? I'm sorry. If there's no other questions, anyone in the audience care to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 549? If not, thank you very much, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you for the information. The chairman will lay over House File 549 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Representative Abrams.
Chairman,
thank you for waiting.
Well, I've been there, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House File 486 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Mr. Chairman and members, for former members of the committee and members of the House last year, House File 486 was included in the Omnibus Tax Bill. It's really a relatively minor provision. There are publicly traded partnerships on the New York American and NASDAQ Stock Exchange, and under a quirk in Minnesota law, there is a requirement that if there is more than $1,000 worth of distribution to a shareholder in one of these publicly traded partnerships, that there would be withholding. Simply, it is an administrative nightmare for both the partnership and the Department of Revenue. All House File 486 does is add to the list of partnerships that are not required to deduct and withhold tax, publicly traded limited partnerships. This conforms with most other states. I think the department is either neutral or supportive, and I know of no opposition, Mr. Chairman.
Seems like a rather reasonable thing to do, Representative Abrams. So, is there anyone in the audience who appears to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 486? Seeing no one, any questions or discussion from committee members for House File 486? If not, thank you, Representative Abrams. Chair will lay over House File 486 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Does that mean we're not going to hear that University of Minnesota Stadium bill?
We're going to hear it soon.
Okay, we've saved the best for last. Representative Bill. We'll get you out of here in time to go to that Ranger party.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And today I bring before you House File 1383, which is a part of an overall strategy in Minnesota to value-add Minnesota's iron ore resources that exist primarily up on the Iron Range. And by doing this, we're thereby increasing the economic opportunity available to people that are working in that area. Also, economic opportunity for the taxes that are collected and then put into different accounts across the state, benefiting different groups. And we're doing this. This bill assists with the development of this emerging technology that is new and revolutionary in the iron ore business. So first off, I would like to move House File 1383, and then, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment, which is the H-138A4 amendment. And I would like to make an oral amendment, Mr. Chairman, to that amendment, if you're following me. On line 14, I would like to strike after the period, after year period, the three-year average production, and then continuing on through the end of line 17. So that would be striking the three-year average production starting on line 14 and ending after the parentheses on line 17. And with that, that is the amendment that I'd like to move forward. If you have any questions, let her rip.
Okay. Representative Dole moves House Bill 1383 and then moves the author's amendment, the A4 amendment, with the deletion after line 14, after a year period, delete line 14, 15, 16, and 17. Is that correct, Representative Dole?
That is correct, Chair Franke.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? The amendment as amended, I guess, is the way we should phrase that.
That is correct.
So, if there's no further discussion, those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, the amendment is adopted.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to give you some background, presently there's the Mesaba Nugget is a bill that we passed previously in a previous legislature that incentivized or helped to incentivize the production of iron nuggets. And presently there is a plant located in Silver Bay at the North Shore Mining Company that has been producing up to 25,000 tons total capacity, and the purpose of the plant up there in Silver Bay was to proof the technology, prove that that the nuggets can be made using the technology, which is of course a new technology, and then also proving that the nugget itself is able to be used in the most modern steel making facilities, which are commonly known as electric arc furnaces. And many times nuggets are used to be included in sweetening scrap steel, just like when you make a cake, you put sugar in it. Well, they raise the quality by putting in these virgin iron units, or 99% iron units, which come from this Silver Bay plant. The partners presently in the company Mesaba Nugget LLC are Kobe Steel, Cleveland Cliffs, Steel Dynamics, and Ferrometrics. This bill specifically does the following. It establishes two time periods when the tax would not, and that's would not, be imposed on the direct reduced iron. And, of course, we're not imposing the tax during two specific time periods to incentivize the production and development of this technology, as well as to help this plant get its feet solidly on the ground as it moves forward into this new era of steel making in Minnesota. The first period of time would be that no tax is imposed on the production of iron nuggets when the production is less than 50,000 tons per year. And of course, that would be double the production of the current pilot plant up in Silver Bay. And this production would be done at a plant that is being developed, a full-scale production plant in the Aurora White Lakes area, which is in Representative just barely, I might add, in Representative Rukavina's district. He was able to slip it across the line, and now it's in his district. It also, in number two, in the second instance, would impose no tax during the first 2 years of commercial production. Now, there is a part of this is that the non-commercial production is classified, as we said a moment ago, 50,000 tons or less. Commercial production would be above 50,000 tons. The first module of this plant, members, will be producing, when it's fully phased in, about 600,000 tons of Mesaba nuggets, or virgin steel iron units. And lastly, is the tax would be phased in over 3 years following the two-year exempt period that we have previously discussed. And then in the years 3, 4, 5, and thereafter, it would be phased in at 25% of the tax, 50% of the tax, 75%, and then in year 6, the full tax thereafter. So again, to go back over the bill as amended, it clarifies the non-production tonnage in any one year at 50,000 or less. It clarifies that no tax will be imposed on the direct reduced iron nuggets during the non-commercial production. And it further, and also it further states that one thing of interest is that the iron ore concentrate, the step that is between the digging it up in the ground and preparing it to put it into the nugget plant, will be taxed at the rate that's currently in statute, just as the iron ore concentrate would be taxed if it were used to produce taconite pellets, which is the current method of production for iron units that go down to blast furnaces. So with that, the revenue analysis on this, the Minnesota Tax Office and the Department of Revenue have stated that House File 1383, not necessarily as amended, but I don't think it makes any changes as amended, clarifies the existing law and policy regarding iron ore taxes, and that there should be no state or no local tax implications from the outcome of this bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, when are they breaking ground on the new plant, and when is the new plant going to open?
Okay, that's a very good question, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, we are the partners are presently in the permitting process and have submitted their entire application for the permits for water and air to the MPCA. There is a bill that is on the General Register that I believe will be up tomorrow that I am the author of that made some minor clarifications and an extension of a time period so that their last amendment for their water quality permit could be accepted as being submitted on a timely basis. I am hoping that this permitting process will move forward fairly rapidly, and that within a year we should be looking at some type of construction and getting the plant started. Of course, you know, there's been the controversy, Representative Abrams, that the plant of one of the partners is Steel Dynamics down in Butler, Indiana. And they are very anxious to get Mesaba Nuggets into their steelmaking process so that they can make more money, essentially, because the value of these virgin iron units is so high right now. And so that we are kind of in a competition with that. However, with Butler, Indiana, so to speak, we're hoping that we're going to get ours done first. However, the concentrate that's going to be made to feed either plant, which is to be located in Representative Riccovino's district or in Butler, Indiana, would very likely be made at North Shore Mining Company up in Silver Bay. So we've got a lot of different angles happening. I hope that answered your question, hopefully within 1 to 2 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Just a brief statement. While I'm interested in the concentrate that we're going to get regardless, I'm more interested in the plant and the jobs and the spinoffs that would come with that facility up north. So you can count me, Representative Dill, as somebody who wants to do whatever's necessary in order to get that going forward for people up in the Aurora Great Lakes area.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Abrams, I certainly appreciate your support. And this is, you know, if you're looking back over mining since the 1891 when this all began up in Tower in Sudan, this is the third real big generation of mining, and this is a very key to the success of the future of the Minnesota's Iron Range, and I appreciate your support.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riccovino.
Chair, I believe under current law, Representative Dill, that the concentrate's tax just the same as a pellet's tax.
That is, Mr. Chairman and Representative Riccovino, that's what I believe I stated.
Yeah, okay. I thought
it's about $2.10 a ton at the moment, right, plus the pricing.
But I'm wondering what the amendment the amendment that you offered, and why we, if they produce under 50,000 tons, it reverts back to a non-commercial plant. Because it seems to be, you know, I've watched the mining companies operate on the range for years, and they would actually do something like not produce over 50,000 tons just to get their taxes down. So once the plant starts, I mean, our concept of why we brought this bill forward was because we had put in law that in order to attract a plant and start adding value to our tax, and we would go to 25%, 50%, 75% over, I believe, is it 5 or 6 years?
6 years.
100%. So, and the mix-up with the plant on Silver Bay was that it wasn't sure because they were already operating now for 2 years, 3 years if they started operating, if they're already in the 25%. That's what we're trying to clarify. Now, why would you would give them the opportunity, or Senator Bach did in this amendment, to, in the fifth year, all of a sudden decide that they're not a commercial plant anymore because they only produce 49,000 tons is beyond me, which we will have to talk to our esteemed colleagues in the Senate. Perhaps the wig was on too tight this week. I don't know, but it doesn't seem to make sense to me that we would put this in this amendment, which you just did. And I'm glad we caught the three-year averaging, but we still also have some other reference above that, the three-year averaging, too. And I think Representative Abrams is following me here. I mean, once you start a plant and they are selling the product, just because they go to a certain amount doesn't mean they go back to being non-commercial.
It's always so much fun to see the range delegation have some internal difficulties here.
I know. I see lines 12 and 13 there, too. But perhaps we will ask our colleagues what they were doing over there and clarify this before the final bill.
I would suggest you get to them earlier this afternoon, not too late tonight, Representative Rukavina.
If you see sparks flying at the Ranger party, you know what it's over.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brooks,
Representative,
I share the same concern because I thought that we had this all straightened out, and this is the purpose of the amendment was to bring over language that was that would be concurrent and the same as what is in the Senate bill, and so I brought that forward because my senator, who I follow very closely, Senator Bach, has suggested that this is the language that we wanted to insert. So I think that we need to have that same discussion, and I'll bring a new one. If there is any new information, Mr. Chair, I will certainly get that to you and Mr. Stone.
Appreciate that.
For laying this bill over, I assume that we can make some mid-course corrections that maybe we'll figure out tonight at the Ranger Party before dinner.
Before dinner, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone in the audience that cares to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 1383? Anyone in the audience?
Mr. Chair?
If
you adjourn.
Well, can we just...
No, Mr. Chair, we are taking names tonight of who shows up.
Chair, I'd renew my motion to lay this bill over.
Okay. The chairman will lay over House File 1383 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Members, I have a couple of orders of business. First and foremost, I have a list of bills that we are going to refer to division. That will be available to members from the committee administrator. They also want to say that we may need to schedule an additional meeting this week, so please keep your calendar open either Thursday or perhaps even on Friday. Now that we have passed the second, or are going to pass the second committee deadline, we are going to obviously step up the number of meetings for the tax committee. With that, Representative Coles, would you care to move the minutes from the March 31st meeting?
There's nothing I'd rather do, Mr. Chair.
We appreciate that. Any additions, corrections, deletions to the March 31st minutes? If not, those in favor of the minutes as written, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are in opposition, minutes are adopted, meetings adjourned.